You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We're continuing our special coverage of President Obama's second inauguration with New York Magazine writer-at-large Frank Rich. Frank, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Did anything from the president's speech jump out at you?
Well, I think, although it may not have been the biggest point of the speech, I think, like many people, to hear the word Stonewall in the civil rights context at an inaugural address was pretty amazing. I thought as I was watching it, would the candidate from the other party even know what Stonewall meant? I'm not sure. Otherwise, I thought the speech was good. I thought he stood strong on some points that he hasn't always stood strong on, like climate change, to take one example. And, you know, it's the first half, as everyone knows, of a doubleheader that will be fleshed out in a few weeks at the State of the Union.
Well, so we're hearing something of a different President Obama from the one who was sworn in 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I also think the real difference from Obama is what's happened in the past few weeks during the, so, you know, the lame duck Congress. I think, to me, the most hopeful changes in Obama's outlook has been him actually drawing a line in the sand on tax increases for the top earners and on refusing to allow the debt ceiling raise be held hostage. And essentially, the Republicans, knock wood, from my point of view, have capitulated on both points in surprisingly short order. And that's a real change. It sort of seems the end of the kumbaya period of thinking these people will negotiate rather than in any serious way.
Some people were surprised that it took him 4 years to get to that point.
Me too. I mean, look, he really got his head handed to him by the Republicans and then by the voters in 2010, and he let a lot of stuff rage out of control, from the so-called health care summer where people were practically rioting at town hall meetings to this incredible anger that manifests itself in the Republican caucus and Congress, in which he kept wanting to see as if everyone sounded like David Brooks. Well, they don't. So I think he's learned something. I hope he's learned something.
Well, the prominent place he put gay rights in the speech suggests perhaps that's one of his priorities in the coming 4 years. What other priorities would you like to see the president focus on?
Right. By the way, on that priority, it's going to be in the hands of the Supreme Court. I mean, he can do some things, but he's sort of done a lot of his piece. It seems to me that if we're to take him at face value, and of course, this is a wish list as much as a reality at an inaugural address. Climate change, as I said, trying to find some way to deal with Iran short of war, although he didn't mention it. I think another priority is obviously going to be the visible rise of al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda-like groups in North Africa. I think that he's talking about infrastructure building, Eisenhower style, second term Eisenhower style. He also entitlement reform, which is not necessarily beloved by the Democratic base, but he made a clear allusion to the fact that he feels we can't spend all our money on supporting people of older generations. And I was also really struck by not only his invocation of middle class, but of really talking about inequality, which to me is just a gaping issue, to me and many others, that just usurps the whole idea of America and American democracy. And so I don't know what a president can do about it, but it's nice to know that it's on his radar screen and he's speaking about it more forcefully than ever, perhaps.
During his speech, the president referenced the coming financial battles and made a thinly veiled attack on his opponents in Congress. Let's take a listen to that.
Sure.
For now, decisions are upon us, and we cannot afford delay. We cannot mistake absolutism for principle, or substitute spectacle for politics, or treat name-calling as reasoned debate. We must act.
So that was another example of him, I guess, drawing the line.
Yeah.
Do you think that this Congress will be any better for him than the last one?
I don't think so, but I'm willing to hold out a shard of hope, only because the president is taking a tougher position, but also this party is the Republican Party is really on the line. They lost this election decisively. They have, particularly in the House, a radical group, and I've written this repeatedly and feel it very strongly. This is a radical group of Republicans, whether you want to call them Tea Party or Tea Party sympathizers or whatever they want to call themselves, that is holding the Republican Party hostage, holding the House hostage, and therefore holding America hostage. And it's really in their hands. I mean, you know, John Boehner has tried to discipline some of these people, but everyone's afraid primary battles from the right, to primary opponents from the right on the Republican side. And so that's the big question mark, and it's really not up to the president or a Democratic president to change their behavior. They're going to have their own sort of come-to-Jesus moment, and it's amazing because they discard facts and reality. They don't seem to want to really act on what the poll results told them, including about a changing America.
Well, in a column for New York Magazine that you wrote before the election, you wrote, "This is a nation that loathes government and always has. Liberals should not be deluded. The Goldwater Revolution will ultimately triumph regardless of what happens in November." You still believe that?
I do. I think, some of that is longer term, but the truth is, as we look back, for instance, after the Goldwater debacle of 1964, liberals and Democrats, people like me, including in the media, were saying this is the end of the Republican Party as we know it. The LBJ landslide was enormous. The right has gone into hiding. And, of course, it was only a year or two later that Ronald Reagan was elected governor of California and began his march to consolidate conservatism. I do feel over the long term, and even polls on Election Day showed it, they're on to something about what a large part of the American public feels. But over the short term, I don't know, because they had a scary defeat, and we don't know what's going to happen in the next year or two, and whether, particularly as the economy still hasn't come close to completely recovering, whether they might step up a little bit, retreat a little bit. When in the case of the Goldwater, the post-Goldwater debacle, it was a big boom time for America, and so the pace of a conservative rise could happen faster than I suspect it can in the tail end of a great recession.
The president also addressed the changing times. Let's take a listen.
"We have always understood that when times change, so must we. That fidelity to our founding principles requires new responses to new challenges. That preserving our individual freedoms ultimately requires collective action."
That almost sounded like a challenge to the Supreme Court, people like Antonin Scalia.
Yes, it did. And, of course, we've seen how far that's gotten him, although you could say there was a little bit of wavering in the court given the John Roberts sort of turnabout on health care. But, yes, I also think it may a little bit relate to gun issues, which were oblique in this address. But, again, you know, I do think there is, unfortunately, in my view, a large public that does not want to compromise their reading of the Second Amendment no matter what.
And then there's the whole issue of whether he is a socialist. He keeps on being called a socialist, although he has disappointed a lot of people to his left who feel that he is very middle of the road.
I find it amazing when people on the right, A, describe him as a socialist, B, describe him as this kind of nasty, brutish, demagogue, constantly vilifying his opponents. You know, this is a guy, as we were saying, who's bent over backwards during much of his first term to placate these radicals. But that's, you know, they really don't like him. And that is, you know, the president starts this term with a roughly 55% approval rating. That's much less than Clinton had going into his second term. It's less than Reagan had. It's a little bit more, I think, than George W. Bush, but he was, after all, waging an unpopular war. There's a lot of contention here to come, and they have not retreated at all from the idea that he is this socialist guy, possibly not born in the United States, who is out to destroy America. And it's not just the far right that says it. You know, you listen to so-called mainstream conservative commentators like Peggy Noonan and Charles Krauthammer during the election season. They think it, too.
Or John Mackey, the head of Whole Foods, who called him a fascist and then a socialist, and he has apologized for both. So I don't know what's left other than to call him a capitalist.
Stranger, that'll be we'll leave that to Donald Trump, I guess.
My guest is Frank Rich, who is an editor at large, a writer at large at New York Magazine. We're talking about the president's speech. Well, you probably heard that Lyndon Johnson said that a president has a six-month window of opportunity after he's reelected, before he has to worry about a new Congress and their concerns about being reelected, and then the buildup to the next presidential election. But do you think that his lame duck situation will be a help or a hindrance?
It's going to be both, obviously. I think I'm hoping it's a help in that it will liberate him. And there already, as we talked about earlier, already seem to be signs of that in his sort of being more realistic about dealing with his opponents. And this is a guy we know who cares about history, cares about his places in history. He's a really young president by the standards of the genre, and a lot of energy, and I think that's all the good. But the down part, of course, is he will be a lame duck. Maybe not quite on as fast a timetable as Johnson would indicate, but on a fairly fast timetable, and it's going to be a brutal election period in midterms, partially because of the whole House is up for grabs. And through gerrymandering, Republican districts are many of them are safe districts, and they're going to be people challenging the incumbents on the right, and that's going to push Congress to the right and become more intractable than it's even been, and sort of maybe end the window of opportunity for Obama that's there now.
Well, there used to be redistricting has changed the whole the whole look of Congress. Many seats used to be up for grabs, and now I think it's somewhere under 40. Because there are so many safe seats. A listener asks if all the talk of gay marriage might be linked to the fact that the case dealing with gay marriage is about to go before the Supreme Court.
Possibly. I mean, if you believe, as I sort of do, that the Supreme Court is not immune to politics and to listening to public opinion, quite possibly. And I still believe strongly that John Roberts, I didn't even quite understand the sort of Rube Goldberg way he got to upholding so-called Obamacare. He cares about history too, and politics, and how he's going to be remembered. And I wonder if this isn't indeed, as your listener said, turning up the heat, because I'm not sure that even a conservative like John Roberts wants to be on the wrong side of history on a major civil rights issue in America.
Now, on the first day of his term 4 years ago, the president signed an order which called for closing Guantanamo. That pledge has still gone unfulfilled. Do you think the president will ever be able to do anything about Guantanamo?
I get the feel he might if he put all his energy into it. I get the feeling, and it's instinctual on my part, but I just don't think this is high up in his list of priorities. And I feel one thing that liberals have to accept is that in terms of the sort of security state and its apparatus, Obama is closer to the Bush administration than a lot of Democrats and liberals wanted. And I don't see that's going to change. And given what's now going on with this very visible resurgency of Islamic terrorism, there's even less motive for him to change it. I mean, this is a president of drone strikes, of surveillance, of keeping Guantanamo open while purporting to want to close it. So, you know, huge prosecutions on security leaks. So that's there we are. I think that's who he is.
Well, there seems to be confusion as to what his foreign policy is. Some were concerned about his handling of the Arab Spring. Iran, which he originally extended a hand to in his first address by saying you can unclench your fist, that doesn't seem to have worked. And of course, there are many people who are concerned about the tension between him and Benjamin Netanyahu, who is likely to be reelected.
Well, I think his foreign policy has been. Not entirely consistent, but it seems to be towards at least a light footprint. And of course, sometimes it seems hypocritical because you behave one way with one Arab nation and another with another where our interests are different. He has obviously drawn down from Iraq and is drawing down faster from Afghanistan. But it seems a kind of situational foreign policy, closer in a way to a Republican realist foreign policy than anything else. That, to me, is such an improvement over the neocon credo of the Bush years. I sort of feel better that than some of the alternatives. I also think Chuck Hagel is very, assuming he ends up at the Pentagon, while I disagree with him on many issues, including all the social issues, Hagel is someone who is a realist by Republican standards. He's not a McCainite, even though they were friends. He does want to obviously take on the job of cutting back Pentagon spending in an intelligent way. So that's, to me, a big signal. But it does seem, in case of the nations involved in the Arab Spring and much else, it's improvised. But I'm not sure there is a one-size-fits-all for the world we live in right now.
Frank Rich is a writer-at-large at New York Magazine. Thank you so much for talking with us again.
Great talking to you. Thanks for having me.